Thank you. Thanks, and thanks to Omar and Richard for the opportunity to participate in this very important series of talks. And bravo to you for what is a real public service for conducting this year after year. And it's a real honor to be sitting next to Douglas and Pat, who are real heroes of mine. I'm going to talk about, the title says Safe Childbirth Checklist, and Richard had asked about really focusing on the development of this tool. And as I was thinking through what I might recommend some of the takeaways be, there's, I think, three come to mind. So one is we will talk about one very specific instrument, which is a checklist that's specifically designed to attempt to reduce maternal and newborn mortality in low and middle income settings. So that's one specific tool. I think, or at least I hope, that some of the lessons learned through this experience could go on to inform perhaps the development of other checklists related to maternal health or child health that you might be engaged with. And then third, more broadly, simply conceptually speaking, the approach to trying to design some type of simple tool or intervention of whatever sort that can integrate into existing health systems in such a way that it's picked up and leads to sustained change over time. And particularly with respect to that last piece, what Pat had said in some of her closing comments really resonated, and that was about changing behavior. And it occurs to me that that's probably a common theme in all three of our talks. You can have the right cook stoves, you can have the right contraceptive devices, you could have a checklist that was, you know, took 2 years and 200 people to design, but at the end of the day, it comes down to whether or not the healthcare worker or whoever the user is decides to pick it up and use it. And in many ways, that's one of the big challenges that we face in a lot of our activity. So, sometimes people end with the slide of who was engaged in the work, but I like to start with it just so you know from the outset that this was a project that has been going on for five plus years and has involved a ton of people and a ton of organizations. So what I'm about to present to you really was the work of probably 150 or 200 plus people from many different types of disciplines over the years, and I'm simply the presenter. And here's some of the specific names we can talk about. I'm sure a lot of them look familiar to you. This is a slide we probably don't have to spend a lot of time on. Suffice to say, though, that this was a tool that set out to try to impact the enormous burden of avoidable mortality that exists around moms and babies, and that includes intrapartum-related stillbirths as well. And when I say avoidable mortality, again, I think probably most people in this room have had similar sorts of experiences. I wanted to throw up just one slide that demonstrates something that happens at ground level that can impact negatively patient care. And this is for people who take care of babies in these settings. This will probably be a very common story for you when sort of one walks into the health center, in this case in India, and sort of scopes out the delivery room and says, is there an AMBU bag around in the event that the baby needs newborn resuscitation? 1 in 10 babies, the AAP says, needs, you know, some sort of help to jumpstart the process of life. And the answer is almost always absolutely. You know, who wouldn't have an AMBU bag? And we do. And so we say, so let's see it. And then once we find it in the room where it's located, it might be in a locked cabinet, and it so happens that the person who has the key is on vacation. And it's tragically not an uncommon story, but it's only one example of many, 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 many factors that I think end up happening at the point of care that limit the capability of health workers to deliver the best care possible. And in many cases, Pat and I were just talking about it beforehand, it's really impossible to even understand what these barriers are unless you're there. You can never think some of this stuff up when you're just sitting at home here in Boston. Certainly I couldn't. I couldn't resist. I apologize. I had pulled together a few slides from different sources for this talk, and I hadn't seen this one for a while. But this was taken in Panama, and what you see here is the newborn ward at this small hospital in Panama, and you see three happy babies. But then down the hallway is the neonatal ward, and there's only one baby, and you see he's not so happy. And so I think what we're trying to do is keep what this checklist program is trying to keep all the babies smiling and not so unhappy, like the poor solo baby in the green. And you know, when we start with checklists, a lot of people, at least in Boston, will associate this with a surgeon named Atul Gawande, who's my senior partner on the childbirth checklist work. And if you've had the opportunity to hear him tell the story, at least his perspective, his take on how checklists started in the world, he'll tell this really fascinating tale of the U.S. Army in the 1930s testing a new plane that was designed to carry bombs farther and faster and to carry more bombs than had ever been done before. And in order to do so, you can't see it on this picture, but they had to put four engines on the plane, so the plane became enormously complex, and they needed two pilots to fly it. And on its inaugural, a large order had already put in for many of these planes. And on its inaugural test flight in Ohio, it flew, it rose, and then it just continued to rise until it couldn't anymore, and then it fell and crashed, and sadly the two pilots died. And when they tore it apart and identified what the problem was, it was just simply that a certain switch that allows the plane to level out once it reaches a certain altitude hadn't been flipped. And what they came to was, it's a good plane, it's just too complex for our human brains, even two of them in the airplane, to operate. And instead of scrapping the plans for the plane, they came on this idea of checklist. And then I think most people who are engaged in healthcare will recognize that over the past few years there's been a bit of buzz around checklists in health, and this childbirth checklist program that I'm about to describe really had its roots in two checklist programs. One was a simple five-item checklist built to improve safety around the time of central line insertion that was developed by a fellow named Peter Pronovost out of Baltimore, and then the surgical checklist program that was developed by Atul and others, and really working between WHO and Harvard. And it was when the analyses were coming in on the surgical checklist work around 2007-ish, 2008, and they were surprised to see that not only had it impacted morbidity, but actually had impacted mortality. WHO said, well, are there other disciplines in which we can maybe leverage this type of tool, and childbirth safety very quickly rose to the surface. And it wasn't entirely clear from the outset. It's still not entirely clear if a checklist approach to saving lives at birth is possible. But that's what we're attempting to find out. So, I think I would like to say that people hear the word checklist and checklists can mean different things to different people, and all sorts of different types of checklists exist in the world with all sorts of different aims and intentions. This was a checklist at my hospital at MGH that's supposed to be used around the time of central line insertion. And as someone who's come to think about checklists now deeply, this kind of checklist is really frightening to me. I don't think it necessarily, certainly not something I want to use. As soon as I don't want to use it, I think I'm less likely to use it, at least in the way that it was intended to be used. And that's why I say even when we started with the childbirth checklist work, a lot of, we tried to engage as many people in related communities as possible, and we'd heard from people, we've done that already. And when we saw a lot of stuff that had been developed, it was simply not what we were envisioning, at least in terms of something that would be user-friendly and something that with which one would would think would be quickly adopted in the field. So that's why I say maybe as we go through this, because we found it's fascinating people. It's really a litmus test. People have different reactions when they hear the word checklist. The surgical community in particular had very strong feelings one way or another. Two pieces of data, though, that I've always found fascinating is when they first started talking about the surgical checklist, and people got a chance to look at it and see it and think about it, and they asked the surgeons, you know, would this be helpful in your operating room with you as the surgeon? Do you think this would have an impact on health? And 50% said yes, and 50% said no. You know, I don't think a simple 19-point checklist is going to change anything in my operating room. And then a few questions later, they asked the same group, well, if you were going under the knife, would you like the surgeon in charge to be using the checklist? And 90% said they had hoped that the checklist would be used. So it was illustrative. So I'll just say on this slide, the checklist that we're talking about here are really to help. The thing about the checklist that I'm going to talk about is that it's not, there's nothing new on the checklist, and that's why for some people who might, you know, clinicians as an example, who might come at this saying that a checklist is trying to affect their sort of art, the art of medicine or the way that they practice, I think another way to look at it is that there's nothing on the checklist that's art of medicine. The checklist is strictly minimum standards of care. And so if that's what people are considering to be art of medicine, well, in any event, that's not the art of medicine. This is just what should happen at each and every event. Now, there's lots and lots of lots that's not on the checklist, and that absolutely is, I think, what I would consider to be the art of medicine. But what the checklist does is simply ensure that minimum standards of care are met. And because it's not new, the content simply comes from published guidelines or algorithms or literature. And you'll see if you start to try to develop this yourself, you will find yourself in a quandary attempting to find the right balance between simplicity and comprehensiveness. You want it to be robust enough such that it can stand a chance of changing an outcome. But the more you start loading items on, you just know for yourself, the less likely you are to actually use it. And I think even from the beginning, when you start to design something like this, you've got to think about the end user and what the product is going to look like at the end. Again, coming back, which is, I think, going to be a theme to this issue around changing behavior. And if the tool isn't something that you want to use or that you personally think that you would use or you would find to be of value, then chances are the people who you're designing it for will feel the same way. And so this program, this is an old timeline slide, and it can be updated with the 2 or 3 years that happened since, but because we were going to focus here a little bit on the design of the checklist, I can tell you that it started in 2008, and the process by which it started was with identifying the evidence. What evidence does exist? What do we know about the practices that are linked with improved outcomes, that are proven to be linked with improved outcomes around the time of birth for both moms and babies, and then a large consultation of key stakeholders, midwives, obstetricians, pediatricians, public health people, policymakers, grant makers, you know, all came together at WHO in the summer of 2009, really first to say, is this even worth doing? And then the group seemed to think that it was, and then to start in on, well, what would it look like and how does it go from there? And so there were a process of iterative refinement really over the period of almost 2 years that culminated in a draft that's a one-page checklist front and back with just under 30 items. And I'll talk you through it in a moment, that went to 15 sites in 10 countries for sort of usability field testing. You know, how we asked folks to sort of informally, I think I have a slide here, this is not a technical slide, but this is what these usability feedback collaborators, the process that they went through, they sort of informally used the checklist in their own setting to get a sense for what works about it, what doesn't, both in terms of the content and in terms of the mechanics of its implementation. And they, all of those people fed back, and that sort of informed further refinements to the tool. So what does the tool look like? Well, if we were looking to impact mortality, I think as most people in the room know, most mortality of both the moms and the babies is clustered right around the time of birth. I should say early on that the group decided this was going to be a checklist to target institutional births versus home-based births. At least at the beginning, that was one fork in the road that the experts seemed to think that the types of resources, human and physical, that would be available at institutional births versus home births would be too different to try to make one checklist that's perfectly applicable to both. So this is focused on institutional births. And what you see in the red box is where most of the deaths would occur, clustered right around the time of birth. And what followed from that was the identification of four pause points. Those are times when the clinician can take a moment out of the clinical practice and just check to see that essential tasks have been conducted. Again, it's a nuance, but it's important. Checklists can be used in different ways. The ones we're talking about are not meant as an algorithm of care that one follows, but rather this is for someone who already knows how to do everything. And once they've already done everything they think they're due, they pick up the checklist and see if, in fact, they had done everything. And if they didn't, that's the time to make a change. This, incidentally, is exactly how it works in the cockpit. Many of you flew here. And the checklist that pilots use, they have two kinds of checklists in the cockpit. One is the so-called do confirm checklist, which means they get ready for takeoff, they do everything they're supposed to do, and then they check the checklist to see if they, you know, did X, Y, and Z. The other type of checklist that they have in the cockpit is called a redo. That's for tasks that are less common. So, for instance, the coffee maker lights up and it gets on fire. That doesn't happen on every flight, fortunately. But if it does, then they haven't necessarily memorized all the steps that you're supposed to do when the coffee maker, you know, goes aflame, and they pick up the checklist and they read and then do what follows. But the checklists that we're talking about here are sort of do confirm, and this is what it looks like, more or less. So this is, I just want to see what I have here. So this is the first page. And it's just a front and back, and what you'll see is the four pause points. So the first page is before birth, the second page is after birth. The pause points were on admission to the facility, just before pushing or before cesarean section, and then on the back it would be just after birth, and that's within an hour after birth and just before discharge. So at each of these steps, the health worker would be responsible for checking to be sure that five or eight essential items have been completed. And these are items that are specifically designed to target the major killers of moms and babies in low and middle income settings. So for moms, this is bleeding, infection, hypertensive disorders, and obstructed labor. And for babies, it's infection, complications of prematurity, and what we used to call birth asphyxia. Now I think we call it intrapartum related hypoxic events. And what happens is those seven conditions that I just described, they are targeted in multiple ways through the checklist. So as an example, you can't read this, but the point that I'm trying to make is that the maternal bleeding item gets hit in a number of different ways, both by educating the mom and the birth companion when they come in to be looking for bleeding so they can bring it to the attention of a healthcare worker, since in these settings, sometimes it's one midwife looking after many women, and we want to engage the mom and the companion to be part of the birth team to improve safety. We confirm before delivery that oxytocin is drawn up and at the bedside, oxytocin being a WHO standard, in terms of getting it in injection to the mom within a minute after birth to prevent postpartum bleeding. And then after birth, similar kinds of items targeting assessment of the mom for bleeding before she goes home. So we capture it in different ways, and that infection piece follows for all of the conditions that I said. In infection is an example. Hypertension related disorders. They're addressed in multiple pause points in multiple ways. A few other elements of the checklist. It starts with referral, because in many settings it could be that the mom shows up at a primary health center, as an example, and there's frankly, maybe she's already suffering from some type of complication, and maybe there's actually no way that primary health center is going to be able to treat that mom appropriately, and recognizing that as early as possible and getting that mom moved to somewhere where she can receive better care would be an urgent priority. The focus on birth companions, there's an emerging literature that says this can make a difference. We know this makes a difference with respect to the experience of childbirth, but there's more data to suggest that this also makes a difference with respect to outcomes. You can imagine in these kinds of settings, if there's a young woman who came from a rural community and she comes to a health center and she's maybe she's just simply not so apt to advocate for herself or speak up for herself in the event that she starts to feel like something's not going right, particularly if there's one midwife, as I said, caring for a lot of women, and or maybe the person's kind of gruff. There's personality issues here. And simply by having someone else there at the bedside, a family member or a friend who can say, wait a second, this is not right, even that small thing could perhaps make the difference. I'm just going to skip through. I'll mention this, you know, on the surgical checklist. It really has just phrases, and the surgical team is responsible for knowing what those phrases mean. Early on in the development of the child checklist, it became clear that just to prompt someone for antibiotics wasn't going to do it, because many people weren't actually sure what the indications for antibiotics were. Hence these sort of qualifying captions. And the last bit about the checklist I'll just say is it's very important that additional modifications to reflect local practice be made. This is not meant to be a one-size-fits-all checklist. This is meant to be a core set of standards that follows WHO guidelines but should be tailored to ensure that it's used locally. It was pilot tested in South India. We can talk about those results offline, but the results were highly encouraging. And it's now being tested at large scale in India in two different states. And by large scale, I mean there's one randomized controlled trial going on in an example of more than 100 hospitals to try to demonstrate whether it impacts morbidity and mortality. I will end with this. Why does the checklist work? So many people... And I agree, the first thing that comes to mind is like when you take a checklist to the supermarket. It's like a prompt at a key moment in care. I get to the register, I'm about to get to the register, I check my checklist, I forgot the milk, I go back and I get the milk. But there's probably some other ways in these settings that we found it works too that weren't necessarily obvious to us from the beginning. One is just the simple nature of defining tasks, defining what's essential. We're talking about health workers who don't necessarily have the benefit of continuing medical education. They don't have the benefit of having textbooks on the shelves necessarily. And from their training, they learned a lot of different things that they have to do. But they don't necessarily have a very clear way to know of all those things that they have to do, what do I really have to do? Because I'm going to be limited in what I can do with any given mother and baby, how should I maximize my time and resources? So that's the first. The second is to highlight system malfunction. That picture that I showed at the beginning with the AMBU bag that was locked in the cabinet, if you can't do the checklist item, if the bag is locked in the cabinet, because the checklist item says the AMBU bag has to be at the bedside before the baby is delivered. And that follows through with a number of different items as well, the oxytocin, et cetera. And so what we've done with the checklist, you can easily walk into a center and just walk through the checklist item and say, because theoretically a woman could walk in at any stage of labor and delivery. So theoretically you've got to be able to do any checklist immediately. So I can walk in and say, can I do X, Y, Z? And if you can't do it immediately, then there's a problem with the health system. And the last I'll just say and end with this is just simply imposing conceptual structure. It's occurred to us when we work in the hospitals, when I was at MGH and I go to deliveries, work with the obstetricians, the mom comes in, she's ready for, she's in labor. I think the obstetrician would say that there's very clear in the obstetrician's mind when the mom comes in the sorts of things I need to look for between time point A and B, meeting. Time she comes in to the time she, starts to push. And then I need to look for other things. The time she starts to push, the time the baby comes out, et cetera, et cetera. And the same for me as a neonatologist. The things that I'm looking for in the first minute of life are different than the things that I'm looking for in the first, after a few hours of life, et cetera. And that conceptual structure, I think we find it's inherent and we almost take it for granted, but it doesn't necessarily exist for health workers in all parts of the world. But the checklist, by virtue of the pause points, can at least help to ground the way health workers think about it in 4 points in time. Thank you. Thank you.
So very simple and yet very effective. For those of us who've been flying around the world, which is most of us for many years, you know, and Dr. Spector did not show the slide of what the number of deaths were related to airline injuries before. I think 2 years ago, there wasn't a single mortality in the United States from airline flying. And a lot of this has been attributed to the over-repetition of the checklist and similar processes that we try to build in to what we do overseas. So I'm going to conclude and continue on the theme of thinking global and acting local.